Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Thank you for joining me. It's Justin Briley here with another edition of the show that gets you thinking every week, Unbelievable, on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday and around the world via our podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to our app, to the DVD, to the book, to all the other things that make Unbelievable what it is these days, including our new YouTube channel. And you'll find today's show, or at least some clips from today's program, available on our YouTube channel. Great to have you with us. Great to know that we've got more and more people tuning in and listening into the program via podcast from week to week. Why not join them, and why not rate and review Unbelievable if you enjoy it wherever you get your podcasts from? We're going to be getting into today's program in a moment's time, but later on, some of your feedback to recent editions of the program and some exciting news from other recording projects and things I've been doing recently around the show. Let's get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, should Christians engage with Halloween and horror films? Yes, it's our Halloween special today on Unbelievable, and my guests are Peter Laws and Michael Cummins. Peter Laws is a Baptist minister with an interesting sideline in engaging in horror films and the macabre. He writes for the Spooky Journal, the 14 Times, and is the author of two supernatural thriller fiction books and a new non-fiction book, The Frighteners, in which he unpacks just why we love to be scared. As a Christian, Peter believes that horror films don't turn people into demon-infested mass murderers, and that Christians are also a bit too squeamish about Halloween. In fact, he recently wrote in Youth and Children's Work magazine that most Halloween parties are all laughs and squeals. They turn scary things into that admirable, noble trait, fun. It's an ideal way to celebrate a key biblical notion that death has lost its sting. Well, opposite Peter today on the programme is Michael Cummins, a pastor involved in deliverance ministry. He's written on the dangers of Halloween, which he believes is actually rooted in occult practices, and has written that the Word of God clearly teaches us to have no fellowship with demons. 1 Corinthians 10 and Ephesians 5 tell us to have nothing to do with the unfruitful works of darkness, and I believe these scriptures warn us of the dangers of Halloween. He also fears that for some people, engaging with supernatural horror films may also open the door to the occult. And he's got a few hair-raising stories of his own on that front. So I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion between my two guests today. Not something we engage in very often on Unbelievable, the whole area of the supernatural, horror, Halloween and so on. But with Halloween just around the corner, it seemed an interesting time to do this. So we're going to be asking, what's the Christian approach to Halloween and horror? Should churches put on a light party instead, or should we just accept that people have always been drawn towards the spooky and the macabre? And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Peter and Michael, thank you for joining me on
thank
the programme
you.
Today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you both. Let's introduce you first of all, Peter, because you've written this fascinating book, The Frighteners, which tells some of your own story of being a bit of a weirdo, because when you go on this sort of, you know, holidays to Transylvania to find out, you know, whether there's anything in the Dracula story and so on, and tell people I'm actually a Christian Baptist minister. You get some odd looks, don't you?
Yeah, I do get some odd looks, but actually, surprisingly, not quite as many as I expected.
Okay.
Since I came out as a kind of horror fan in the Christian world, I've been surprised at how many other Christians have said, well, actually, I find these sorts of subjects quite interesting too, but I didn't think really I had permission to be interested in them. And so, yeah, I've been encouraged by that to find out that actually there's a lot of other weirdos like myself. And in fact, there's so many that in some ways they're not quite
worthy
of the label weird.
You're not as weird as you thought, after all. And you do very well in the book explaining why, as far as you're concerned, you don't think there is necessarily a big contradiction between being a Christian and being engaged and interested in that side of...
Absolutely. I mean, I see that as a kind of fundamental part of being a human being, you know, of exploring darkness and light, you know, and how they contrast to one another. And so it's it seems sensible to me to be a human who also wants to contemplate the kind of the big subjects like death, mystery, evil, things like that.
What's your approach to Halloween then? We heard a little bit from your article in the magazine.
Yeah, I mean, my approach to Halloween is to say firstly that I can understand why many Christians would struggle with the idea of Halloween. And if Halloween was indeed what many people seem to think it is, if Halloween was an opportunity for people to celebrate actual evil, and if it was a festival that was creating danger and, you know, people making human sacrifices, of course I would be against that. But I do find that the people who do struggle with Halloween, I worry that they may have a kind of knee-jerk reaction to it and have not fully thought through some of the origins of Halloween, but also the simple fact that it can be a positive, even a Christianly positive festival to celebrate. So I'm open to Halloween as being a pro thing.
Okay. I'm sure this will provide some interesting discussion between my guests today. Michael Cummins has also joined us in the studio. Michael, you've been involved in deliverance ministry for a long time, so you sort of have been fairly hands-on in that sense with the supernatural rather than the whole more Hollywood version, if you like, of it. Do you want to tell us a bit of your background, though, before we get into that? Because you kind of became a Christian as a young man, and that was having had some rather supernatural type experiences, yes, yourself in your own life. Do you want to explain that briefly?
Well, I come from a very disenfranchised, poor working class family in London. My father was an Irish Roman Catholic, and we always believed my mother was a Romany Gypsy. But it turned out through DNA tests a lot later that she was actually Jewish. And we was brought up, and my mother was a very, very strange woman, very mystical in lots of ways, and my father was just a straight working class Catholic. And when I was 9 years of age, I went to join the Scouts, actually. Somebody asked me to come and join the Scouts. I had had diphtheria and tuberculosis while I was six, and I needed building up, and I went there. And we went on the first Sunday to church parade to take the colours into the church, and I was attacked as I went in the church quite viciously.
And when you say attack, do you mean in some sort of demonic way?
Well, high screeching noises in my ears, buzzing noises in my ears. I felt my body being pushed and pulled. And when I came out the church and walked home, I was about a quarter of a mile from where I lived. I started seeing things in the house, and my bed would shake of a night when I got on it. They would be tapping on the windows, and
it sounds like something from the Exorcist film. You know.
It was very, and the most frightening thing was I was actually picked up on the bed off the bed one day, levitated on the bed and thrown on the floor. And I, of course, being a boy, all I cared about was football and cricket. I didn't know what was going, and I went to my mother and asked her what was happening, and she told me, "It's the devil come to claim your soul. You've got to resist him." Gosh. And this went on for 9 months, and I endured this every night. The school teachers thought I was a lunatic. I thought I was deranged, but I wasn't. This was a true experience. And one morning I prayed to the Lord, the only experience I had, because I wasn't baptised, because my father being a Catholic and my mother not being one, we never went to church.
Right.
So one morning I got up and prayed to the Lord. Because we said the Lord's Prayer, sang three hymns at school every morning, but I prayed to the Lord one day.
You did what you could.
And the room filled up with light. And it was bathed with light, my bedroom, and all the fear and the pain and the anxiety just disappeared. And I went through life in the 60s doing all the things I shouldn't do, but the Lord never gave up on me and called me back later. And
I've
pastored three churches.
In adult life, churches, in the deliverance ministry and so on. As I say, you've got a lot of stories you could tell, whether we'll have time to get to them, we'll see.
No.
But I mean, fascinating that you got that experience.
Yes.
I mean, we might touch on this as we go on.
Okay.
Let's just see. But what about Halloween then? Because you've written in kind of concerned tones, really, about what's behind the Halloween festivities. And a lot of people think of it, obviously, as harmless fun. It's just, you know, kids dressing up in costumes, knocking on doors or whatever.
Yeah.
But what's your concern? Is there something deeper here that we should...
What I tell you today is all based on experience, being a deliverance minister for 30 years, that I have met people that have needed to go through deliverance, people who have got heavenly evolved in the occult. And when I speak to people, I try and find as much out regarding their background.
Mm.
And I've said to people, how did you first get involved in the occult? What led you into the occult? And many of them have said to me, I became interested after Halloween, and I started reading about Halloween and reading its origins and what it was for and one thing and another. Anton DeVay said the best thing I've ever heard about Halloween, Anton DeVay, who led the Satanist Church in America, he said, I'm glad that Christian parents let their children worship the devil at least one night out of the year. And it's probably the best statement I've ever heard on Halloween. But, on Halloween, it is regarded in the witchcraft circles that the vow between the living and the dead on All Hallows Eve, or Samhain as it was, is at its thinnest. And the dead who have died in a certain place that year before will return
back.
So
as far as you're aware, in the, as it were, occult community,
yes,
it is seen as having some particular significance.
Oh, yes, Halloween. Yes. It's probably the occult community probably see it as their third greatest festival.
After, well, I'm not familiar with what the other ones are.
After various other festivals,
Well, let's go to Peter. I mean, this, I'm sure you've come across this kind of perspective on Halloween before. What makes you think that there's not as much?
Well, I suppose that what I find interesting about this response to Halloween, and particularly and talking about the origins of Halloween, is a really interesting one, because a lot of the information that you hear said about Halloween comes from a kind of closed group of sources, and often they are presented in religious tracts and leaflets and pamphlets, which I've seen quite frequently. And they make claims about the origins of Halloween, which are not actually as well backed up historically as we might hope they would be. For example, I mean, when you look back at Samhain, which is, I mean, it is spelled Samhain, it's spelled that way, pronounced Samhain. Back then, for the kind of the Celts at the time, it was this idea of the end of the summer and the beginning of winter, and it would be a time when they would kind of naturally think about, moving into a more sort of dangerous time and the prospect of...
A darker period,
yes. Mm. Yeah, it didn't necessarily entail all of this idea of kind of cult worship and human sacrifice that I've seen in some tracts. And in fact, when you look back at those cultures, they were illiterate. They didn't write down their history. We only have like oral history based on them. And really it was later when monks and things started writing about this tradition where we started to get ideas about it. But basically the idea that kind of Samhain was this sort of celebration of the devil is not necessarily based, I think, in historical fact. What is interesting, though, about Halloween, I mean, let's take the actual name itself. Mm. The name Halloween is a thoroughly Christian name. It's
based on All Hallows Eve.
Exactly,
right.
Yes. And it's this opportunity that the church would have each year to remember on November the 1st, to remember the dead saints, and then on November the 2nd, to remember like all saints, like everybody else. And actually, it's a natural time of the year. There's a rhythm to life, and it's a natural time of the year for people to contemplate darkness, mystery, death. We look around and we see that the trees that have been blossoming throughout the summer are dying. And so it is a natural time to think about those things. I personally think it makes sense for human beings to contemplate and think about the morbid, the dark, the mysterious, and the dark, because that is just a fundamental part of human life, and to skip over that doesn't make sense.
Right. So to kind of try and avoid that with a light party when we are actually physically entering into a darker period of the season, in that sense, is almost to kind of deny that that's part of our experience.
Well, it's a missed opportunity, I would say. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a lights party. I can understand that. But we don't want to create, I mean, particularly for children and teenagers, we would do that. But we don't want to create an unrealistic world in which, the world of Christianity only has sweetness and light. You know, it's the same principle behind some parents who now refuse to read classic fairy tales to their children because they have darkness in them.
Yes. It's surprising when you go back to the old fairy tales just how much children were exposed to, in a sense, quite dangerous, dark ideas, whereas now they're all terribly sanitised in a way. No one ever gets in any danger or experiences any...
Exactly, the Hungry Caterpillar, the Gruffalo. I mean, these are all nice things, but in some senses you could argue that they are creating a world in which is unrealistic for children and kids. So I suppose what I'm saying is I think fundamentally human beings are curious about these subjects, and Halloween is a natural time where we would do it, a natural part of the calendar.
I'm going to come to you in a moment, Mike. Just a reminder for anyone listening, though, if you want to get in touch with today's show and offer your thoughts on this, and obviously many American listeners via the podcast to Unbelievable, and maybe Halloween's sort of got a bit of a different culture, I think, in the US to what it's had traditionally here in the UK. But either way, be interested to hear your thoughts. Email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch, of course, via the Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Twitter is @unbelievablejb, and links to all those and today's show from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're talking about Halloween and horror films today. I'm sure we'll get to that as well. My guests are Peter Laws and Michael Cummins. Peter Laws, a Baptist minister with an interesting sideline in engaging in horror and the macabre. His new book, The Frighteners, unpacks just why we love to be scared. And opposite him, Michael Cummins, a pastor involved in deliverance ministry, who's already told us about what he thinks are some of the, dangerous, perhaps, aspects of Halloween in terms of its origins and so on. I mean, coming back to that, Michael, Peter making the case that, look, Halloween in some ways just reflects the fact that we are all, you know, we live in a world of dark and light, and to somehow deny that isn't necessarily being realistic, and it may be an opportunity, Halloween, to sort of to acknowledge the reality of the darkness, but to sort of make, if we're making fun of it, if we're treating it none too seriously, we're almost snubbing our noses at it, it could be said, and that's perhaps a thing to be welcomed rather than to be worried about.
Well, the thing is, when I was a child in South London, whether it was a working class thing, and I'm 67 next week, I'd never heard of Halloween.
Right.
I never knew a Halloween party. All we knew that was firework night.
It is rather a modern thing, I
and
suppose.
And it's a modern thing. Yeah. I think maybe the showing of E.T. when it first came out, which is based around a Halloween party, got...
And we've adopted a lot of the American customs.
We've adopted a lot. I mean, Doug Harris, the late, great Doug Harris, told me when he went to see his son in Pasadena, he went to local churches and the pastors and the congregation was all dressed up
for
as
Halloween.
Ghouls, as phantoms for Halloween, because the Americans take no notice of those sort of things. I can only speak by what I know, and I do know particular people that got involved in the occult through an interest in Halloween. It was a basement bargain level way into the occult, and from that they went on to tarot card readings and they went on to Ouija boards and stuff like that.
So for you, there's inevitably... it's just possible it's going to open the door.
Not everybody. There are people there that can go out and have a good time and come home and have too much to drink and that sort of thing, as they would do in a lot of Halloween parties. There are people that can do that. There are people that are vulnerable. There are people that are suggestive and get suggested by these sort of things. And, you know, as Peter said, people are inquisitive. They probe. Sometimes people go in a bit too far in a subject. It's okay if you've got someone there, if you've got a pastor there who can say, well, okay, we've had a Halloween party, we've had a bit of fun, but let's not let it go any further. You know, if there's someone there to bring you in, rein you in, then that's great. But a lot of people are doing all this stuff on the internet in their own homes.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I did read a statistic somewhere, a Catholic, I think, who oversees the sort of exorcist side of that, says since the birth of the internet, they've seen more issues with that sort of stuff, because people are now so easily able to kind of connect with other people who are into the occult and so on. You know, it's the nature of the internet. And I suppose that's the danger, isn't it, that Halloween, you know, just doing a little... Halloween night might be relatively harmless in itself, but if it sort of just pitches someone towards, oh, let's have a bit of fun with this Ouija board now, that's where you see there's obviously going to be some danger in terms of where... I mean, what's your view on all of that, Peter? Do you think sort of, you know, there is this kind of Is it a gateway towards that sort of thing?
Well, I would argue that it's a gateway the other direction.
Okay.
And so I grew up never going to church. My family never would dream of going to church, and we just had no interest in it. And I was really quite anti-Christian growing up. What was the thing that started making me think about spiritual matters? It was horror films and Halloween. They were the only things in society I could find that actually took the supernatural seriously. They told me that maybe there's such a thing as life after death. Maybe there's such a thing as objective good and evil. Mm-hmm. And so I actually found that when I was at school, let's say, and the local youth group would come in and they would, you know, hey, follow Jesus and all this, it would just turn me completely off. They would present light and it just didn't seem to hold any weight to me. I'd go home, though, and I watched, say, The Exorcist, which is, you know, widely thought of as being a blasphemous film. But ironically, that film is also banned in Tunisia on the basis of it being Christian propaganda.
Right.
Because it so clearly presents a Christian worldview.
And as I understood, it is based on a sort of story that was written by a Catholic, or was based on sort of...
Yes, William Peter Blatty was a guy who wrote the story, but he based it on a news report of a real-life exorcism. Yeah. But what I guess what I'm saying is, you know, these, particularly in our modern age, where there's a sort of relentless, be rational, there is no such thing as the supernatural. It doesn't surprise me, therefore, that you get particularly young people who have a hunger still for the supernatural, and they are drawn to these sorts of topics. Now, we could either present them as being, oh my word, you are basically worshipping the devil. I don't think that's a very particularly helpful way of looking at it. And also, it's reading in to things that perhaps could be harmless. I mean, I was interested, Michael, when you said earlier, when you had these experiences, they must have been scary, these experiences when you were young. Your mother's instant response was, it's the devil come to claim your soul. I mean, I'd be terrified of that if I was a kid. But this sort of assumption that the devil is at work in these sorts of things, I find not that helpful. And even with subjects, for example, that I meet with people who... Christians who'll say, well, ghosts, for example, there can't be any such thing as ghosts. They can only be demonic entities. Again, even that topic, I mean, if you were to look at the Bible itself as ghosts featured in it, I'm not saying necessarily ghosts exist, or I don't know, but I'm not going to just write them off as always satanic.
Sure. I mean, what about that issue that I think Michael is particularly concerned about is when it does lead people down a path to say, Halloween's fun, let's have a bit of fun with a Ouija board now. Can't do any harm, can it? I mean, do you kind of have any concerns over sort of people actually starting to, I don't know, potentially open themselves up to...
Well, I mean, I wouldn't do the Ouija board now, but I certainly have done
that.
Oh, yes. I mean, when I was growing up, because that was my way of saying, hey, the world is telling me that there is no such thing as the supernatural.
And what was your experience when you did that?
Well, I was quite cynical, and so I had experiences which thrilled me and excited me because they opened the door to potentially there being something left after death. So that it was a quest for reassurance that there was life after death. It certainly wasn't a quest for like satanic power or anything like that. So it was a noble quest. Nothing really majorly exciting happened, but there was enough in there for me to be intrigued by it. These days I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing those sorts of things. I don't do them myself. But I'm not going to assume, therefore, that anyone who has an interest in this subject, or even if there's people out there who are dabbling in it, and people do. I mean, there's like teenagers right now, they'll be sitting in their sixth form and doing it.
Yeah.
To me, what's the most effective way? Do we swing in and say, burn that thing, Satan is going to take your soul, which is one option? Or is it that you are clearly on a quest?
Sure. I mean, I guess it's always, you know, and for you, it was obviously part of a journey towards Christianity and recognizing that. What's your view on this, though, Michael? Can there ever be a positive side to kind of people's interest in the occult, in, you know, Ouija boards?
Well, when my mother said, I've got to resist the devil, it wasn't just, there was other things that was happening in the house that she had experienced, and my father, like changes of temperatures in rooms. And there was one time when there was a vicious draught in the stairs, and this was summer months, and there was other things that had happened, and it was extremely frightening. I can't explain to anyone unless they've been through it the terror I experienced. With regards to Ouija boards, I've dealt with loads of people who dabbled with the Ouija boards, who was trying to. I can think of one case in particular, I went to an estate called the Dickens Estate in Edmonton, North London, and all the tower blocks are named after one of Dickens' books. And I was called in to see a family there. The lady next door had lost her husband, and they decided to have a seance and try and contact him from beyond through the Ouija board. And things started going wrong in the house. There was lots of stuff that was very, very bad. And I went in the house, and there was a young boy there who was absolutely terrified. And there was a dog that wouldn't come in the house. He wouldn't come in the house at all. He stayed in the garden. We couldn't get him over the threshold. And when I prayed for this woman who had taken part in the seance, she levitated off the floor.
Blimey.
So I knew there was something wrong in that house. And this is not something that we can talk away by saying it was harmless fun. You know, they had opened themselves up to something very, very serious, you know, and I had to spend a lot of time with them till the house was in order.
Did that situation get resolved in the
end? It did. After a time, it did get resolved. I've got a scripture I'd like to quote if I can.
Yeah,
Isaiah 5, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. We have to be careful. Now, I'm all for a bit of fun. You know, because I'm a father of four myself, but I know we have to draw a line.
Yeah, it's a case of where you draw that line, I suppose, isn't it? And for you, Peter, I'm sure compared to many Christians, you draw the line a bit more loosely than they might.
Yes, but I suppose I draw my line in a similar way to many people outside of the church. So there is a credibility issue in a sense that people will come along and hear the devil is at work in and is lurking in every street corner argument. And they can hear that and can find that quite a shocking thing to hear, because for them, they are not even thinking about their kids doing the Ouija board or worshipping Satan. They're going along to a Halloween party and their kid is dressing up as a zombie. And I think that's the main kind of thing that I'm trying to defend here, is that there's a sort of hysterical knee-jerk reaction to Halloween, which I just think is unwarranted with amongst Christians. There's nothing wrong with letting your kids go to a party dressed as a zombie.
I mean, maybe as Christians we need to try and remind people a little more of the Christian origins in that sense of Halloween.
Absolutely.
I do remember... My sister will be embarrassed at me mentioning this. I remember my parents were pretty anti-Halloween growing up in a Christian household. And I remember my younger sister desperately wanted to go to a Halloween party with her friends.
Yeah.
And my dad said, why don't you dress up as a bishop? Because, you know...
That's scary.
it's all Hallows Eve. That didn't go down well with my sister at the
Probably
time.
Probably not.
Anyway, we're talking Halloween and horror films. We'll come on to horror films next on the programme today. Unbelievable. With my guests Peter Laws and Michael. Cummins. Peter Laws is a Baptist minister who's got an interesting sort of sideline engaging in horror films and the macabre. His book, The Frighteners, is out now. Michael Cummins is my other guest, a pastor involved in deliverance ministry. And make sure you get in touch with the show as well. We'll be making sure to let you know how to do that again a little later on. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Join me, Justin Brierley, as the big conversation continues with Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward.
Purposes emerge from the bottom up, from a purposeless process. That's the genius of Darwin's idea.
Well, I think that's a heroic project.
It is.
I don't think it's a possible one.
Michael Roos and John Lennox.
I think the physical resurrection is totally unimportant.
The problem of physical death has actually been solved historically. I want to know about it. To say it's irrelevant, I just don't understand, especially from a philosopher.
Join the conversation on life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's edition of the programme. Ahead of Halloween here on Unbelievable, we're asking, should Christians engage with this particular festival? And what about horror films as well? One of my guests is a bit of an expert on that front. He writes a regular column reviewing horror films. He's written his own supernatural fiction books, and he's also the author of a book called The Frighteners, unpacking why we love to be scared. But interestingly, he's a Christian. He's a Baptist minister. And I'd be interested in hearing what you think about this, because when I was reading your book, Peter, I must admit, my reaction, I think of myself as a pretty open-minded guy.
Yeah.
But even I was like, I don't know. I I guess it's partly because I don't enjoy horror films.
Yes.
And that makes a big difference, I think. I find, especially the gory stuff, stomach churning. And I just I don't know why people want to watch that stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have a very different experience. What happens when you watch some kind of gory slasher horror film?
Well, I suppose what's interesting about this topic is that I can totally understand why some of your listeners will be thinking, like, what? Like, why would you even like that sort of stuff? There's an author called Lynn Thatcher, which he talks about a thing called the spooky gene. And he just says some people have it and some people don't. Some people just find this sort of thing off-putting and they would never dream of being engaged with it. Other people do, and lots of people do. I've had experiences when I've been a minister and like a little old lady in a Bible study has leaned forward and said, oh my word, that was so exciting, that bit when the tent peg went in the head. Did that mean that that old lady was a psychopath? No. What it does mean, however, if you look at human history and culture across the ages and across time, we have actually found that like humans do find themselves wanting to contemplate the things that are relevant to them. Death is incredibly relevant. Suffering is relevant to us too. Some of the great works of fiction have endured not despite their gory parts, but because of them, because they address things that are relevant to us. And so it's no surprise to me that that is still a part of our culture and a growing part of our culture, particularly because, I mean, we live in a world now where, let's say, dead bodies, for example, are not so visible. And the Victorian age, maybe you'd have a Memento Mori photograph of Granny up on the shelf and an actual corpse on the shelf. You wouldn't do that now.
Mm.
But what's really interesting is because we don't really have a lot of experience of real-life death in front of us, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, you see the ascent of its image in culture.
And so people kind of seek out that somewhere else, in a sense, because we're kind of wired a little bit to kind of to deal with the fact of death.
We
kind of look elsewhere if it's kind of insanitized in our everyday experience.
Absolutely. And it's not to glorify it at all. So for example, like my novels that I write, they're dark and they have, say, like murder scenes which are not pleasant. The reason why I do that is not because I find death a thrilling experience. Actually, I find these subjects really quite scary. I'm disturbed by evil, suffering and death. Maybe even more than you are.
Than the average person. Yeah.
I'm sensitive to that subject.
Okay.
So how I deal with that is I take the furniture of that which scares me and I put it into a format that I'm in control of. And so I can write a book or I can read a book or watch a film in which actually I'm having a safe experience of these topics. And that is actually a helpful thing for me.
I mean, but how do you kind of, I don't know, put that side by side, you know, watching a gory slasher movie with, you know, what Paul writes in Philippians 4, verse 8, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Which doesn't make me think of Freddy Krueger, you know. So
What was the first word of that?
Finally,
whatever is that, whatever,
brothers and sisters, whatever is true. Okay.
Yeah, to live in a world and to develop a culture around us that denies the very clear truth of death is just absurd. And so it's normal for us to want to think about these things. But also, and this is the funny thing, I always get confused how people can equate and think that, say, watching a horror movie is the same as a real life murder. It's completely different. In the same sense, I watched Murder, She Wrote last night, right? Mm. Like when I watch Murder, She Wrote, which is a show that revolves around a corpse, it wouldn't make sense without it. I don't think like general people who are watching that are rubbing their knees, celebrating real life murder. It's a completely different thing.
And you know, I would agree. You know, I played my fair share of shoot 'em ups when I was a kid and they didn't turn me into a marauding maniac with a shotgun or anything. We can distinguish between fact and fantasy and so on.
Yes, and there's even arguments in the studies to suggest that actually these can be a good way of letting out some of our aggression anyway. So you mentioned, you know, violent video games and things like that. People can assume, oh, well, obviously that's going to turn young people into psychopaths. But actually, when you chart the development of video games from the late 70s to now, you will find a surprising drop in youth crime. And you would think it would be the opposite, but it's not.
So some of these things are more kind of tabloid sort of hysteria than fact. Michael Cummins, who you're here as a deliverance minister. I don't know. I know that you don't have as much kind of general knowledge about the horror film genre and everything. That it's not something that's particularly interested you that much. I mean, what do you make of the general view, though, of Peter?
I don't know really what you would say is a horror film. Now, I grew up watching Hitchcock. I adored Hitchcock. Mm. I loved all of his films.
Yes.
My favourite was Dial M for Murder. I just loved those films.
Right. Yeah.
And I do remember, this is the worst thing I can remember about a horror film. I used to live in Mitcham in a block of flats, and I came home from work. I'm a plumber by trade, and I came home from work one night, and there was a lady out on her balcony, and her name was Jeanette. I knew her very well, and I said, what's the matter? And she was shaking and shivering. I said, what are you doing out on your balcony? And she said, I went to see The Exorcist last night, and I'm too frightened to go in the flat. Now, she had a baby about 6 months old. I said, where's the baby? She said, upstairs in the cot. I said, well, come in. I'll come in with you. Till when your husband comes home. And she wouldn't go in. And I said, okay, I suppose I'll have to stay out here with you. And I stayed out with her for about an hour and a half. And we listened for the baby to see if the baby cried until her husband come home. And her husband said she'd been up all night. The slightest noise, the slightest light that come in the room, she would get up and she would be... Now, I saw The Exorcist about 30 years after that. And I have to say, I think that probably it was, out of any horror film I had seen, it was probably the most pro-Christian horror film
I had ever seen.
Because it showed in the end good overcoming evil, even though the Jesuit priest, I think his name was Father Carus, took
the
demon in him and jumped through the window.
Spoiler alert.
it showed good overcoming evil. But I think it's all down to fear.
Yes.
I think that maybe if you're a bit titillated by fear and you've had a bit of a shock, it's one thing. I used to go to the midnight movies when I was a kid and see The Devil Rides Out, Dennis Wheatley and stuff like that. And I used to think it was great because it'd give you a shock.
Yeah.
But when fear actually takes hold of someone, that's when it becomes damaging.
And now, is this just personalities as far as you're concerned? Some people shouldn't be going and watching horror films because they will then get scared of every bump in the night.
Yeah, and I'm not evangelical about horror. And so, you know, I would never, I mean, I preach in churches, I never stand there and go, you guys should be watching horror films, because a lot of people just don't like it. But what I'm interested in is there are millions and millions of people who support this genre and love it. And for me to kind of swing in as a Christian and scoop people up and say, let's get out of this dark place, I don't think that's very, very helpful. And so horror has a lot of positivity to it. And the fear aspect, I mean, yes, I mean, this woman was obviously terrified by that and she found that a horrible experience. So maybe not watch that again. But there are plenty of people who actually find that thrill of the fear as being a pleasant experience. I mean, the classic example would be somebody going on a roller coaster and finding a safe experience of fear is actually an adrenaline rush for us. And that's kind of normal.
And
I don't want to demonize.
I don't know, part of maybe the fact that we live in such a sanitized, safe world most of the time, we kind of seek those adrenaline rushes elsewhere that we might have used to get by, you know, having to go, I don't know, hunting an animal or something
You know. Well, yeah, completely. And obviously, I mean, if you wanted to look at it from an evolutionary perspective, I mean, having fear is an incredibly important part of human survival. If we don't have fear, we will not survive. We'd be dancing in the motorway, you know. So we have to have this and we have to grease the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that experiences
fear. And so there's
fear.
Just some people for whom kind of horror films do that, and others for whom obviously it's not good. I mean, do you have any concerns, residual concerns though, Michael, that again, like the Halloween thing, some of these films might be a gateway towards people dabbling?
I mean, when we look at 2 Timothy 1:7, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, love and sound mind. When you open someone up to fear, I truly believe that they become unhinged by fear. And they become frightened of everything. And sometimes they become frightened of things that are not there. I mean, I've prayed for thousands of people. And one of the things that you have to deal with when you pray in deliverance is fear, is the fear element. You have to take that away. You have to restore them to Christ through love and take this fear element away from them, because they can become so unhinged by it, they become frightened of everything. Now, I'm not saying horror films is the only source of that, or Freddy Krueger or whatever. You know, some people have fears of spiders and snakes and rats and all sorts of fear. And it's very, very unnatural. I saw a big guy get on a chair once and I said, well, what's the matter? And he was a big fella and he said he saw a spider and he was petrified. Now, obviously, there's something latent within us that
that creates that kind that of creates re- that type response. Of fear. But there's other people who almost seek it out. And do you kind of, does that concern you, the people who really love going to the film and watching and getting scared out of their pants?
Everyone has free will. God has given us all free will.
Yeah.
Some people choose to exercise free will in that area. Now, that's their choice. It's not for me to criticise them in any way. I just say, as I say to all people, be careful.
That's a wise maxim.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose this is a very good point that you make about, like, when you are transfixed by fear and it takes over your life, it's not a positive thing. But I suppose this is where I guess I would put that argument back to the people who are really kind of scared of Halloween. And I kind of lose count of the amount of Christian friends that I have who will go to Sainsbury's, let's say, and walk down the aisle where the Halloween things are. And they are in fear because they think, oh, my word, it is the devil's night. He has control. Mm. Let's stay in our houses. To me, that actually is raising fear more and glorifying the devil more. I think as Christians, we can have great confidence to laugh in the face of death. Because death has lost its sting. It's not to, we take these subjects seriously, but like Halloween, we mentioned earlier, horror films are perfect opportunities for us to be confident.
Well, here's my big concern. As I say, not a big fan of the horror genre anyway, but fair enough. We all like our different things. Mm. But at the same time, the bit of the horror genre I struggle the most with is what's sometimes in term rather nastily as torture porn. This idea that the really gratuitously gory, sadistic kind of the Saw films, those sorts of things where people... And I do wonder what... When people turn up to watch basically people being tortured, is that good? Can we really justify that? I just sense that maybe that's going too far.
No, I can sympathise with you. I do know what you mean. And the term horror, I think people can hear the word horror and just assume we mean extremely violent things. Mm. But you can have a horror film that is about a kind of spooky haunted house. Yeah, there's not a drop of blood.
There are different versions.
There are different
it's
versions.
It's a spectrum, sure.
But I have found that the people who really like the kind of the gory stuff, again, it doesn't necessarily equate to the fact that they want to do this in real life. But they like to have high-stakes adventures. They like to have films in which it feels like the stakes are high. And so for some of those people who like that, they like the creativity of the gore, for example. Mm. So, you know, like I go to horror conventions, I speak at those sorts of places, and people come, I've seen whole families come in dressed as zombies. They have spent hours and many amounts of money to build, like, you know, half a head or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like an artist...
It's worthy of Hollywood, some of this stuff, I'm
Oh,
sure.
absolutely. Yeah. And it's a kind of artistic expression. And the people who do this will say, oh my word, that's such a clever way of doing that effect. And so it's a kind of expression of creativity. Now, crikey, if these people were actually then therefore going and being creative in real life and murdering people, that is a completely different ballgame. But there actually isn't a great deal of evidence to say that people do that, that people will be warped by watching a horror movie or a thriller and go out and do this sort of thing.
What do you think about the sort of more extreme end of the sort of that stuff?
And do you mean things like snuff movies and things like
well,
that?
I don't
well,
know.
I wouldn't spot them.
I think it's not quite that, but it's more kind of the extremely graphically violent
Especially with children, we hear a lot in the media about young men who have committed awful crimes. Mm. I heard this morning coming in on the car radio that there was a young boy of 10 who's been arrested for raping a young girl of 6. Now, what would get in a young boy's head of 10 that he would go out and commit such an act? He must have been exposed to him somewhere. Maybe he's seen pornography. Maybe he's seen videos, child porn videos. And, you know, all of this stuff, when you have vulnerable people, and, you know, there's lots of vulnerable people in society, and, okay, we can make them aware of darkness and light and the origins of darkness and light. But, you know, people... tend to look at the light as being sissy, not much in it really. So they tend to go to darkness. And like, again, I say it's down to the individual. I think some people cannot handle it. And when we see young boys like we see now committing sexual crimes and rapes very, very young, there's got to be something behind it. They've got to be influenced somewhere. We know the internet is mainly unpoliced. Mm. So they can get this stuff off the internet.
I mean, obviously, we're not equating, say, pornography or whatever with horror films, though there's inevitably there are mixing of these genres and so on. But at the same, but I think the principle there, which is okay, given that that stuff we know is kind of making young boys' minds who are exposed to, say, hardcore pornography in ways that previous generations never were because of the internet. That's changing their psychology, changing the way their brain is wired. We know that that's a fact from research. I mean, is there any danger that as the horror genre has become more and more, if you like, explicit? I mean, the stuff that gets past the censors today compared to the 1960s is a completely different ballgame, isn't it? Is there a danger that we kind of almost desensitize ourselves in some way to these things that and kind of, you know, even you know, the kind of TV shows we regularly watch these days, you know, Game of Thrones and whatever, have the kind of graphic violence that, you know, would have been outlawed, you know, in a previous generation.
No, I think, I mean, pornography is one thing, and that's a kind of a different ball game, because I think when people, the thing about when you watch pornography or a person who's experiencing a pornographic image is it tends to make the viewer want to experience what's going on the screen.
Okay.
But actually, when you look at the psychology of people who are watching horror movies, they do not tend to relate to the killer.
Okay.
They tend to have the thrill of the chase of, oh my word, there's someone in peril.
Yes.
And so they relate to
More with the victim in a sense.
Yeah,
than
absolutely. Yeah, and then there's the kind of triumph at the end. And sometimes there's variations on that. But no, I don't see like horror as kind of programming people to be potentially dangerous. And I would argue for the opposite, that there is a cathartic part of this that is important. A good example would be, and I think with children and young people particularly, that they are simply drawn to these topics. And I interviewed a head teacher who said it's very, very unusual to find a child who is not going to be excited when you bring in a skull of an animal, or is not going to be thrilled when you tell the story of the plague. And horrible history leaves the gory bits left in, because it gets our attention, it makes us interested, and it's novel, and we're fascinated, and our fascination by these topics do not therefore mean we're supporting them. A good example would be, you know, when someone's driving on a motorway and they see a car crash, there is something in us that might make us want to look to see what's going on. And many people would say, oh, is there something wrong with me? Am I supporting that? No, you're not. Your brain is hungry for information and wants to try and avoid a fate like that yourself. And so this, in the psychology studies of people who have watched horror movies, sometimes there is kind of this cathartic experience when they're watching other people in peril, but they're not in real peril because they're actors.
Right.
And people are sophisticated enough to know that.
I'd be interested in talking a little bit about some of the other things that I've kind of, I guess, Harry Potter, for instance. Now, most of the Christians I know have no problem with Harry Potter. It's kind of become just another fairy story that we're quite happy for children to be exposed to. In fact, you know, many Christians I know would say thoroughly endorse it and say, you know, it's good versus evil. It's that sort of thing. I remember when it first came out, though, you know, the Harry Potter books and so on, and because they were such a big international best-selling thing, there were some Christians who initially were concerned and said, is this in some way going to glorify / draw people towards the real thing, you know, witchcraft and whatever. What's your view on that, Michael?
Well, I have to be honest, I've never read a Harry Potter book and I've never seen any Harry Potter films.
So you're like one of those I've never seen Star Wars people.
Well, the thing is, I've never had any interest in it. I don't have small children any longer.
Right, yes.
So it's something I'd never watched. I have had phone calls from people who have said to me that they believe their children are getting very involved in the spell side of Harry Potter.
Okay.
And there was one lady, she went to school and they found an exercise book with all spells in Eye of a Newt and Brains of a Frog and all that, and this child was trying to make a sort of spell up. Now, is it harmless fun, Harry Potter? I don't really know if it is or not. I mean, the sort of films and television that I would talk about are far more reality sorts of things. Things like Ghost Adventures.
Okay, so those kind of...
Yeah, those sort of things, I think, are quite...
Those spook hunter type
programs. And I have taken part in a deliverance recently in New Jersey in America where a lady got very, very badly damaged by her daughter.
Had she been involved in one of
these programs? Well, her daughter was a guest on Zach Fagan's show, Ghost Adventures, and she went down there and she came home after filming it in Florida and went back to New Jersey. She lived with her mother and her husband. They lived with their mother. And they were both Catholics. They were all as an Italian Catholic family. And when she got back, her mother noticed that her daughter had changed, her personality had changed, and she'd become different. She said she didn't really recognise her. And she said her eyes had become darker and there was things about her that wasn't right. Well, the daughter started, and she'd been married, happily married for some years. She started an affair in marriage. She started having an affair and took a lover. And one day the husband came home and found them together. And he murdered his wife and murdered the lover.
Gosh.
And it ended up he was given two life sentences in a state penitentiary. And the woman had called in the Catholic Church because she said there was poltergeist activity in the house. And she was a very religious Catholic. She had 76 crucifixes around the house. And she would go shopping, and when she came back, they was all turned upside down and things like that. And she was very frightened.
So this sounds like something out of the real-life version of
She called in the Catholic Church, and she had three exorcists. Now, I'm not an exorcist. I'm a deliverance minister. Right. Slightly, totally different. And they couldn't get rid of it. And she asked me to help. And the house was cleansed within an hour and a half. And she was okay. Also, she had crippling injuries. She had rheumatoid arthritis that left.
Now, in your view, Michael, that all stemmed from this interest in the supernatural, doing the Ghost Hunter programme and all the rest of that. That something was allowed in at that point.
Well, if you see Zach Fagan's show and you see some of the things they do, if they realise there is, shall we say, a demon in a house. Now, we know demons are real because Jesus confronted them and they're spoken about in the Bible. What they do, they wouldn't call, shall we say, a Christian in to exorcise the house. They would call in a shaman, a Red Indian shaman. They would call in people like that to do some sort of New Age spells and that sort of thing to drive this demon out. The mother is convinced that the daughter brought the demon back with her.
There's a lot of atheists who listen to this show as a podcast, and a lot of them will be thinking, I can't believe any of this stuff. It's all psychological. It's all, you know, it's something going, it's, you know, that's what's behind people having these experiences. There's no ghosts and demons and whatnot. I mean, Peter, this isn't the area that your book really deals with, but where do you land on this whole thing?
I'm quite cynical.
Okay.
If I'll be honest, I leave the door open, of course, to the potential of supernatural activity in these sorts of ways or demonic activity. I think it would be kind of wouldn't make sense for me to close the door on that. But I do find that the tales I'm told of these sorts of things, a lot of the times you could put them down to mental illness being misdiagnosed. Obviously, if there's things like, you know, people levitating off the bed, I mean, that's a little bit of a different thing. But again, I mean, you have to have kind of corroborating evidence of these sorts of things. But no, I can be a little bit cynical about some of these claims. And what I worry about is that many of the anti-Halloween, anti-Christian, anti-horror films rhetoric is based on the claims of some writers, people who've said they used to be members of covens and they've come out and they're talking about this massive conspiracy of, you know, witches against the church and all those sorts of things. And they've ended up being proved as being fraudulent, you know. And
so people have exaggerated and kind of done things that kind of made a bigger deal or at the very least misremembered what really happened in some situations.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to suggest that these sorts of things can't potentially happen, but the majority of situations, we're talking about, you know, just a general guy who's watching a horror movie or a family who might want to take their kids to a Halloween party. And to me, to respond with, the demons are coming, is a shock to most people.
Yeah, I mean, what about this? The trend towards these, you know, reality TV shows where they go into supposedly haunted places and see if they can find. Is that just? Do you say it's just part of our nature? It's part of our makeup, or?
Well, in some ways, it's a positive thing. I mean, it's an encouraging sign that in a world where which we say worships rationality, people don't seem to be as keen on that. And so they follow the more paranormal interest. And what's interesting about the explosion of paranormalism today is that it's in some ways it's kind of a resurrection of Victorian spiritualism, which is trying to have a kind of scientific view
My only concern, I suppose, and maybe Merkel and I share a bit more ground on this one, is that it's all part of the same thing I see when I drive past my local pub and it says Psychic Night this Tuesday. It's people who are looking for answers, but probably in the wrong place.
No, and I'm not saying, like, then it's great, let's leave them there.
Yeah.
But it's an encouraging sign to say human beings are not that willing to give up an enchanted worldview. And that gives the Christians an opportunity to share what I think is a thoroughly supernatural worldview, which is Christianity.
What's your thoughts on this, Michael?
Well, I have to tell you that all the people that I ever took through deliverance, and in 30 years, I've only met 6 people who have been demon-possessed.
Mm.
And you could rate them alongside the girl in the film The Exorcist, who did things like... Only 6 people in 30 years.
Okay.
Most people have... really a level of fear within them that they've been frightened by something, and that fear has opened them up to various other things.
Okay.
One thing that which is quite interesting, one day I was asked to go to Springfield Hospital in Tooting, which is a psychiatric hospital, and actually a lady was trying to stop herself by being deported, so she claimed she was mentally ill, and she asked for a pastor, and because they knew me there, they asked me to come.
Mm.
And I walked through an open ward, and a lot of the guys there had smoked a lot of bad marijuana. They was in there because they had various problems. And I walked through this ward, and I'm an ordinary guy. I consider myself a very ordinary guy. You know, even though I'm a deliverance minister, I live a very ordinary
life.
You're
one of the most down-to-earth deliverance ministers I've ever met.
I walked through this ward, and the psychiatrist was taking me to see this woman. They all started screaming and rocking in their chairs. As I walked past, it was quite unusual.
Mm.
And I said to the guy, "What's the matter?" And he said to me, and he was a Hindu, he said, "We all need prayer in here."
Mm.
And that's what he said. And I ended up praying for him for the work he did as well. So, yes, I understand that Christians mustn't say there's demons under every dustbin lid. They mustn't live like that.
Yeah.
Because, as we say, Christ on the cross has defeated Satan. Now, is the devil real? Yes, he is real. Because why did Jesus have to go on the Mount of Temptation to overcome him? So we know this is true. So what we have to do is have a balance. And it has to be a healthy balance. We mustn't frighten people, especially in churches, because I've been to churches where I've seen bad deliverance ministers shouting and screaming at people, doing no good at all. And so we have to have a healthy balance.
I think it was C.S. Lewis who, in his introduction to the Screwtape Letter, said something along the lines of, there are two equal and opposite errors people can fall into.
Yes.
Either to disbelieve in the devils entirely, or to believe in them so thoroughly that they see them everywhere.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. But C.S. Lewis is a good guy to bring up, because Lewis, when his wife died in Surprised by Joy, he talks about a moment where he felt that her presence, that she came to him in some way. A ghost.
But that was obviously not a negative experience.
It wasn't a negative experience. And so it was a supernatural experience that he didn't instantly slot into the demonic category.
When my father died, I was very upset because we were very close, and he was 91, and I was missing him awful. And where I live, I always come down the stairs in the morning. There's a mirror at the bottom of the stairs. I always comb my hair or brush my coat. And this particular morning, now, I looked in the mirror to comb my hair, and I saw my father's face looking at me, smiling.
Oh, gosh. Now, you didn't think of that as a negative thing, then?
No, I didn't.
No.
I felt good, and I felt peaceful, and really, I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I just felt fantastic. And for some reason, you see, my father gave his life to the Lord the day before he died.
Wow.
Someone was visiting the home he was in from the London City Mission, and my daughter was there, and she called him over and she said, "Would you pray for my granddad?" Now, he'd had 7 strokes over few months, and he couldn't really speak. And he said, "Okay, what's his name, Bill?" And he put his hand on him, and he said, "I'm going to pray this prayer over you. If you can say amen, or make a noise," and put his hands on him. And he actually said amen clearly. And he died that night. So I believe my father was with the Lord.
We're going to take a quick break into our final section. Been fascinating talking to you both today. Peter Laws and Michael Cummins with me. We've been talking about Halloween and horror films, and we'll continue or finalise our discussion in just a moment's time.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
We'll be returning to the final part of our discussion programme today very shortly, and some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Looking back at last week's programme, in which we had a conversation on doubt between Ed Atkinson and Austin Fisher, plus some of your other thoughts on some other shows we've had recently. Excited to say, of course, that our final edition of the Big Conversation series will air next week here on the podcast and, of course, via the Big Conversation show. It's moral philosopher Peter Singer, who's well known as an atheist ethicist, and Andy Bannister, a Christian thinker from the Solus Centre for Public Christianity, debating, do we need God to be good? It's a classic question, but we're going to be looking at biology, morality, evolution, and so on, and whether our moral sense, the idea of human rights and so on, may have any grounding in the concept of God. It's a classic question, and we'll be doing it with two really interesting thinkers on our final edition of the Big Conversation. What a fabulous series it has been. And if you haven't yet signed up to receive updates, more news, episodes, bonus content and all the rest of it, do that at the website, thebigconversation.show. And we're very much hoping to bring you a second season of these big hitters on The Big Conversation in 2019. So watch this space for that. It's been an exciting past week, actually. I got to sit down with N.T. Wright, the famous New Testament lecturer and scholar, to record the first episode of the brand new Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast. Now, if you're an Unbelievable listener, you'll have heard me mention this the last couple of weeks. But can I encourage you, if you haven't, to get yourself registered at that particular website? That's asknwright.com, to join the newsletter for that particular podcast, which will be launching in mid-November. And of course, to be able to ask your questions there as well. We're going to be continuing to record episodes of the podcast on a continual basis, where we'll ask more questions that come in. And what a lot of questions we had in already. And it was great to sit down and ask a number of them with him this past week. Exciting times as we launch a new podcast very soon. AskNTWright.com if you want to get hold of that. And you too. I was able, at the very short notice, to go and see one of my favourite bands in the world performing at the O2 in London in their Innocence and Experience tour. I've posted a little commentary and a photo or two on the Facebook feed of Unbelievable if you want to go and check that out as well. All of the links, of course, to our social media available, as usual, from the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Look forward to hearing your feedback as well to today's programme, and I'll give the ways to get in touch very shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's the final part of today's edition of the programme, our Halloween special, asking should Christians engage in the festival, and what about horror films as well? Peter Laws and Michael Cummins have been my guest on the show today. You described yourself before we came on air, Michael, as a fundamentalist Christian, and you've got no problems with people knowing that you're not old at all. You're old school, as
very
far
old
as,
school.
But at the same time, I find you very down to earth and very realistic about the spiritual realm. And you certainly don't glamorise it in a sense. But there is always this danger, isn't there, in people who are involved in supernatural deliverance ministry and so on. Sort of it can almost become a little bit of a show sometimes, let's say. I guess there are dangers, excesses that you've seen in your time.
I've seen some terrible deliverance. I've seen someone once punched in the jaw.
Oh dear.
Because the deliverance minister decided he had a demon in his face and he hit this man on the jaw and knocked him to the floor. I've seen people take liberties with women and touch them inappropriately because they have decided that there were demons in certain parts of their body.
Oh dear.
And I've seen some terrible deliverance. They need to be stopped because, you know, Jesus Christ is the deliverer, not a pastor wearing a shiny £500 suit and driving driving a Rolls Royce to church. They're not a deliverance minister. Jesus is a deliverer. And when I personally do deliverance, before I even say one prayer for someone, I find out everything about their family background, everything about their own likes and dislikes, whether they've been divorced or not, whether they've suffered serious illness in their life, and I get the biggest picture I can of these people. And of course, the most important thing is you need discernment from the Holy Spirit, that you have to spend a lot of time praying and asking the Holy Spirit to reveal you know, the mysteries of this man, so he can be delivered. Deliverance is important. Jesus did it, remember? When he found the woman bent double, he decided she had a spirit of infirmity. And he cast the spirit of infirmity from her. And that way she became straight again.
Well, I mean, we've kind of strayed into this area, which isn't your speciality, I know, Peter, deliverance ministry.
Although I was once, there was a article about me in the Daily Star, I think it was, and they put the headline, Britain's leading exorcist. What? It was just because I gave a talk at a premiere for an exorcism movie, so I got them to change that.
Interesting.
But no, it's not my...
No. But, well, when you're not being Britain's premier exorcist, I mean, obviously, you watch a lot of films that do touch on that whole area, though.
Yes.
Do you tend to find that Hollywood... in any sense is realistic, or does it kind of give a very different version of what's probably actually happening on the ground with people like Mike?
I have extreme caution with this topic, and the world of exorcism and deliverance ministry to me, and I don't know a great deal about it, but to me it does feel like a kind of wild west of people who could potentially, I mean, you seem like a nice guy, you know, but there's people out there who are, I mean,
doing all kinds of crazy things.
The examples you've given, this of the abusive examples, are clearly wrong. But what about the kind of the psychological damage of basically labeling someone who may have a mental illness with a demon? And there's accounts of, I mean, I read one just recently about a little girl who had epilepsy, and her parents were saying, well, it's not epilepsy, she's possessed by the spirit of witchcraft. And this is incredibly dangerous. And people are dying, you know, and there's cases where people die at the...
Would you're nodding your head for that, Michael.
The young lady, Victoria Clombier.
That's a massive example.
She was misdiagnosed as having demons because her parents kept taking her to the church saying she was demon-possessed. She was actually suffering from severe malnutrition. And that led to, of course, great fear. If you don't expose a child to any of those things.
But there are obviously, you know, many instances of abuse and the wrong, you know. So I think, as you say, it's very important that these sorts of ministries are carried out, if they're going to be carried out, under obviously some kind of guidance or supervision, or some sort of, within some sort of structure that will make sure that abuses don't occur.
I have if I'm ever going to pray for a lady, my wife would always come with me. If my wife is not available for whatever reason, then I would ask a lady from the church to come with me. And you take every step and precaution before you go to make sure that everything is right.
And how do you discern when someone doesn't necessarily need deliverance needs, but needs medication or kind of psychological...
Well, you know, I would say that to them straight away. I think you're suffering from depression. Have you been to see your doctor about your depression? Maybe the doctor can give you something to... Now, a lot of people say depression is caused by demons. Now, there are certain depressions. If someone suffered a bereavement, for argument's sake, they're going to feel depressed. If someone's lost their job, they've been made redundant after many years, they're going to feel depressed. Now, what you mustn't do with people like that, of course you can pray for them and restore them, and you can ask God to come into their lives and take away their sadness or their grief, to give them the peace. You know, we're taught that the peace of God surpasses all understanding. So if that be so, then God always has a remedy for all things.
We're going to have to draw it to a close. It's been such an interesting discussion, both. Thank you very much for coming in. People want to find out more about Peter's stuff, peterlaws.co.uk. And as I say, the new book is The Frighteners. Look out for that wherever you get your books from. Online, I'll make sure there are links from today's show to both my guests. Christ Sets You Free is the website from Michael Cummins as well, if you want to find out more about him. And, well, however you're going to be approaching Halloween this coming week, I hope that you have a good week. And thank you very much both for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's discussion. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to get hold of me on email. You can also Facebook me, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, to get in touch with the show that way and to see what we post up there on a regular basis. On the Facebook page, at unbelievablejb, to follow me on Twitter and get the same kind of thing. Also, don't forget that today's show has been recorded as well on video. If you want to see some of the clips from today's programme, get along to the Unbelievable channel on YouTube. YouTube.com/PremierUnbelievable, I think, is what you're looking for. But you can find the links from the show page as well. Lots of other videos that have been provoking interest there, of course. And as I mentioned, next week marks the sixth and final episode of The Big Conversation, when I'm sitting down with Peter Singer and Andy Bannister to talk about morality, biology, evolution, and that kind of thing. But the very first episode we had with Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore, over 850,000 views now of that on The Big Conversation and at the YouTube channel. So if you want to go and check them out, I've been posting up as reminders on my Facebook feed this last week some of the great episodes we've had over the last few months. New blog actually just released on that Jordan Peterson episode from Esther O'Reilly, very talented young Christian blogger who was featured on the programme a few weeks ago with atheist James Croft. And she's written a blog titled "What's Stopping Jordan Peterson from Rejecting the Resurrection of Christ?" So if you want to go and read that particular article, do go over to the Facebook page, or check out the Big Conversation blog as well at thebigconversation.show, and you'll be able to read it there. I'm going to get into some of your feedback now, but straight after Unbelievable today, Steve Uppel joins me. He's the pastor of All Nations Church in Wolverhampton. Got a remarkable story himself of his whole family coming from a Sikh background originally, their conversion, and what he's seeing happen in his local area. His own life and ministry. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon on Premier Christian Radio, or as its own podcast, the Profile Podcast, wherever you get podcasts from. A reminder that a whole brand new podcast launches from Premier soon, the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast. AskNTWright.com for more info on that and to get yourself registered. Looking forward to that podcast releasing in mid-November. Thanks to those who've been in touch about recent editions of the show. Last week, Austin Fisher, a pastor and author of a new book on doubt, came on to chat with Ed Atkinson, an ex-Christian. And I asked you to send in, if you've got stories of going through seasons of doubt, conversion, deconversion, or whatever, to send them in. And I had some really interesting ones, actually, in by email. Clinton in Durham, North Carolina, says, "Thank you so much for Unbelievable. I've been listening for about 2 years and have gone far back in the archives. I so enjoyed the episode with Austin Fisher and Ed Atkinson, as well as the Big Conversation show with John Lennox and Michael Roos. My own faith journey is from a childhood fundamentalist faith to an adult agnosticism, with a long stop as a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church. Around 2 years ago, I had a crisis of meaning and ended up attending a small Christian church that's become a very important part of my life. I am a Christian now, but often find myself feeling uncomfortable with the level of certainty many other Christians seem to exhibit. I'm sure many people wouldn't consider me a Christian. I'm not certain of the full truth of the Christian story. I'm not sure there's an afterlife, but if so, I'm still a small U universalist. Like Austin, though, I've come to find out I'd rather be wrong about Jesus than right about anything else. Following Jesus has brought me deep healing. I've had my share of personal tragedies, including a long bout with depression, and it's given my life new meaning. Often I find myself agreeing more with your non-Christian guests, but this time I found myself nodding along to Austin. I think the difference is the refreshing lack of certainty and honesty about that. Even though I don't share the need for the absolute truth that seems to accompany some of the more apologetics-focused guests on the show, Unbelievable has been a huge part of me returning to the Christian life, and I can't thank you enough for it. I'd love to hear from some Unitarian Universalist or Christian Universalist guests in the future. Or if there's some episodes that I've missed about Universalism, I'd love to know that. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Clinton. Such an interesting story for you to share. And I will send you some recommendations, actually, where we've done some of those sort of Universalist issues in the past. Mark Garnett is another regular listener of the show. Says, "I always appreciate the podcast, but there are some episodes that connect with me more than others. I suppose that's just part of being human, finding and enjoying the things with which we relate. The show this week about doubt struck a particular chord with me, as I've wrestled with doubt continually over the past 5 years. Having grown up in a Southern Baptist context, I always saw doubt as the enemy of my faith in Christ. It was early January 2014, in the mountains of Honduras, that my accumulating doubts became too heavy for my Baptist worldview, and it snapped in half, leaving me a broken and aimless man in his mid-20s. I nearly walked away from my faith altogether. It was only by learning to lean into my doubts that I found solace in a world where God really does exist, intervene, and love. I now know, in as much as I can know, that God is far bigger than my doubts. He's not afraid or threatened by them, and I'm pretty sure he wants me to be honest with them. If I'm wrong, then it seems so were a good number of biblical characters who wrestled with the same doubts that plague my mind on a near daily basis. I wrote a book about my experiences in Honduras, my doubts, my crisis of faith, and my slow reconstruction. I sent you a copy last year. No, you're a very busy man. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. Rest assured, no expectation that you will. That's perfectly fine. I did, however, want to throw it into the electronic wind for anyone in a similar position, those who desperately want to believe in God but find it difficult to overcome their doubts and questions. It's called From Scattered Ashes, and it's available on Amazon, both physically and digitally, for just 99 cents. On a personal note, Justin, I love the show. I've recommended it time and time again to my friends, believers, skeptics, and those questioning alike. Appreciate your hard work. Hope it continues for years to come. One of these days, I'll hop across the pond and invite you to grab a drink, my treat. Mark, it's just a treat to receive that email. And I do have your book, and I shamefully have not had a chance to really dig into it yet, but I want to. It looks really good. So I'm, even without having properly read it myself, I am going to say yes, do if you can get hold of that book, From Scattered Ashes, by Mark Garnett, available from Amazon. And perhaps, Mark, we could get you on the show at some point to talk about your own story as well. Let's just get a couple more of these in. Just a couple of interesting ones I had from people who want themselves to engage more in the conversation on faith, doubt, how we know what's true. This one from CJ on Facebook said, really enjoy the show, love the debate and quality of conversation. I'm a Christian pastor in Winnipeg, and your show and others like it drew me in. And I ended up asking David Smalley to be on his show, and he had me on. And for those who don't know, David Smalley is an atheist who runs his own podcast, Dogma Debate. I'd love to continue having conversations like that. Any advice as to how to make that happen? Atheists you know of that would have a guy like me on their show. Regardless, keep doing what you're doing. It's a great job. Thank you very much, CJ. I can only say that I think put yourself out there, have those conversations in the digital sphere, and soon enough you'll run into people who are running their own podcasts, write, post stuff, get it out there, and take whatever opportunities come along. Essentially, don't be afraid to write in to me, to whoever, and say, I'd love to appear on your show here, have you thought about this? And soon enough you'll find yourself popping up here, there, and everywhere. Andrew Murphy has a show idea, says, I discovered Unbelievable a few years back, immediately became a fan of the show, really like the way you host and lead the discussions. Unfortunately, haven't been able to listen as much as I would have liked to recently. About a month ago, I bumped into some Mormons on the street, and we've met up to discuss our similarities and differences a number of times since. I'd really appreciate it if you hosted a discussion between a Mormon and a Christian on your show. I think it would be really interesting, as they seem to hold very similar views to Christianity in some regards, yet differ wildly in others. Well, we have done a few Mormon Christian debates, if you search through the archive, Andrew. The last one being between two editors of a book about Mormons who came to Orthodox Christian faith in conversation with a Mormon. Search back in the archive is always the way to go, and you might find something that you'll enjoy there. David in Newcastle, Australia says, loved the podcast with the Hitchens versus Hitchens debate, and of course Dennett versus Ward on the big conversation. And these have both solidified in my mind a couple of questions I've been trying to clarify for months while listening to believer versus non-believer on your show. These aren't for you to answer, I don't think, but perhaps next time you have a non-believer on the show or something. The first question is for the Christopher Hitchens types who like to make a judgment of God on their own terms and will conclude things like God is immoral or not great, or if God is there, then he should have or would have done this or that. And the first question is, if there is an all-powerful, all-knowing God who is unconfined by time and space, should we expect to understand him? And the second question arises directly from observing the conversations you set up, Justin. Hitchens, Dennett and Ward, four brilliant minds who all look at the same evidence, having studied at many of the same educational institutions, but come to opposite conclusions about whether something as significant as a creator God is even there. So the second question I have is, if God intended to create a world where everyone has completely their own choice as to whether to follow God, could he have done a better job of it? Now, if you don't think God should have created such a world, then see question one. Thanks again for all you do with Unbelievable. David, I appreciate that. Interesting questions. I will see if we can get to asking them when they come up. And Dennett versus Ward, that fifth episode of The Big Conversation. Again, it's been going down well on our YouTube videos at thebigconversation.show and, of course, the podcast as well. Got some interesting reactions to it as well that I haven't had time to bring yet. This one from Tim in Nagano, Japan, says, you couldn't have a much bigger conversation than that between Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward on mind, consciousness and free will. In your limited time, you could only scratch the surface of such a broad subject, but there was one itch you didn't scratch that I kept thinking about. Dennett seemed to be referring to information as almost a synonym for consciousness, but the point I'd want to press on him is that of the origin of such information. As a materialist, he presumably believes that information just emerges as a natural consequence of the laws of nature, chance and time. That's essentially the same as how Darwinists view the origin of biological information. It's just an emergent property, which without a mind to produce it, is the only option left. No known mechanism can produce new, complex and specified information, the kind that life requires. But if your philosophically determined worldview limits you to only natural physical mechanisms, then a kind of hand-waving emergence is the only option you have. At any rate, I would have liked to hear Dennett explain how he can account for the origin of this information he kept referring to. Keep up the good work on the big conversation. And Charlie also gets in touch to say, just listen to that interview with Daniel, Keith and yourself. Enjoyed it very much. One thing I find is that naturalists never define the idea or quality of nature. They use the term as though it's a given. But even Darwinian theory does the same. But we never go to the source level of the question of existence itself and the presence of life to define exactly what nature is. As far as we know, we cannot explain existence. We cannot explain the existence of life and we cannot create consciousness. Natural selection means that nature had to select, and selection is a product of consciousness and will. Do these choices make attributes arise from electrons? Does life arise from electrons? Does consciousness arise from electrons? All I know is that electrons have an energy of attraction and repulsion and randomness and an ability to combine in predictable configurations within certain conditions defined by the laws of existence and physics. Nature probably derives its qualities from these properties as well. But if this is true, why haven't we been able to create life from electrons and consciousness from information? God knows how all this originates, and God knows we can only understand it, but not recreate it ourselves. Thanks, Justin. Wonderful show. Time to get my phone fixed. Apparently, you haven't been able to get the podcast as regularly as you'd like because your phone's on the blink, Charlie. Well, how are you listening, whether it's via the podcast, via some listening device, via your radio set? Glad to have you with me. Do come back again. Next week, we've got the final episode of The Big Conversation. Give you some info on that in just a moment's time. Straight after Unbelievable today, on the profile, Steve Uppel, the pastor of All Nations Church in Wolverhampton, is my guest. Check that out on its own profile podcast as well. For now, it's time to love you and leave you and say, do come again next time.
You're unbelievable.
It's the sixth and final episode of this season of The Big Conversation as I sit down with moral philosopher and atheist Peter Singer and Andy Bannister, my Christian guest, to debate morality, biology, and whether we need God to be good. Thanks for listening and see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.